Good afternoon. Welcome once again to Line One, Your Health Connection. I'm your host, Dr. Thad Woodard. My guest today is Anchorage neurologist, Dr. Marcy Troxell. Why don't you pull up a chair and join us today, and we'll examine some new information on migraine and the chronic headache. If you've got questions or comments about what you hear, give us a call. You can call us directly at 550-8433. That's 550-8433, and it's only during the next hour or so. Our toll-free number is 1-888-353-5752, and our email address is line1@kska.org. Marcy, welcome to Line One.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
It's a pleasure to have you. So you are a relatively new neurologist, been here just a couple of years?
Yeah, about 2 years, coming up on 2 years now.
Tell us a little bit about your training and a little bit about yourself that you want to share with everybody.
Okay. Well, I was actually born and raised here, so I grew up in Anchorage and left for all my medical training. And I went to medical school at University of North Texas College of Osteopathic Medicine, and that was in Fort Worth. And then after that, I did my neurology training at Baylor College of Medicine, and that was in Houston. And after I finished my neurology residency, I did a fellowship in neurophysiology. And my emphasis there mainly was a specific test called EMG and nerve conduction studies. And that's just a method that we have of testing the nerves and muscles in the body and looking at various pathologies there. So I finished that fellowship and then came back up here. And I'm working now at the Alaska Neurology Center and doing general neurology there.
What percentage of a day do neurologists deal with headache? I guess what I'm truly getting at is I'm guessing it's got to be one of the most important reasons for patients to come to a neurologist.
Yeah, it is. It's headaches are associated with a lot of disability for patients. And especially the population that I'm seeing, because often by the time they get to a neurologist, they've gone to several other physicians for treatment for their headaches. So, I see a good number of headache patients. I would say at least 30% of my practice, 40% of my practice would be headache patients, at least, I would say.
I'm also going to guess that a big concern among patients who might be listening or the general public is that the headaches are an indication of something very serious. Is that your experience or not?
Actually, that's not my experience. And again, I'm dealing with a patient population where the headaches are often very severe or happening very infrequent or quite intractable and resistant to treatment. And I think for patients, a lot of times that does bring with it a sense of, well, there must be something really, really wrong because this is very painful and significantly impacting my life. And I would say that the vast majority of headaches that I see are what we would call primary headache disorders. And that really means that that you usually aren't going to find an underlying cause for the headache. So when you go looking and you take a picture of the brain, no tumor associated, no aneurysm or anything like that.
So the corollary of what I heard you say is that severity of symptoms do not necessarily correlate with severity, a life-threatening or particularly dangerous problem.
Yeah, as a general rule, I would say that that is true. And the exception that I would make to that rule is that if even if you're a person that's had headaches for years and years, if you very suddenly have a headache that's the worst headache you've ever experienced, different from what you're usually used to experiencing, I should say, and very sudden in onset, then that is a headache that should be evaluated. But yes, for the most part, severity doesn't necessarily correlate with any ominous underlying sign.
When you see a patient with headache, what are the qualities, the timing, the information that is helpful for you to rather quickly get an idea of what might be going on?
Well, timing is one of the most important things. You know, again, if you see someone that's had headaches for 25 years and they've been going on fairly unchanged, then you can usually feel quite comfortable that there is nothing ominous underlying that. So timing, you know, how suddenly it's gone on. Another important thing is how frequently the headache's occurring. We always want to get an idea of the characteristics of the headache. And the reason for doing that, again, is because with these primary headache syndromes, we try to classify them into different types of headaches. And the reason that we do that is because that helps us really more directly target what medicines we want to use. So instead of just using a general analgesic or pain medication, then we're targeting the specific type of headache with a very specific medication, and that helps to get relief faster for the patient. And so when I'm going through and asking questions about headaches, the main things that I'm trying to do with the questions that I ask are to quickly assess if it's a headache associated with more ominous signs or more of an emergency type situation versus a more chronic or long-lasting disorder, and then also characterizing the type to pick appropriate therapies, and also deciding what diagnostic tests I think need to be done and in what order.
So again, we're learning over time is that not all cancers are the same. So what I'm hearing you say is not all headaches are the same. And if we can understand the specifics of the headache, then maybe the reasons the headaches are there, the underlying pathology is different. So the treatment approaches and workups are different.
Right, yeah.
So what? Give me some examples of maybe you already mentioned a sudden onset, a very severe, worst headache ever. What are some other kinds of symptoms or frequencies and prodromes or triggers and so forth that people may have with headaches?
Right. So, with migraines, which I think we're going to be talking about a lot today, and one of the more common headache types that I see, characteristics of migraines include an aura often, and an aura is something that a lot of people kind of think of as the warning syndrome to their headache. And auras most commonly involve visual changes. You can see dark spots in your vision, bright spots, zigzagging lines, a lot of things like that. And then there are also other things like sensory changes and less commonly weakness or vertigo that can be associated with that. And that's kind of a warning that lets you know the headache is coming on. And then with a migraine headache, the characteristics of that typically, it tends to be, but isn't always on one side or the other, it tends to be a throbbing type headache. It often can last for hours or sometimes even days. And very frequently is associated with sensitivity to light, sensitivity to sound, nausea, and vomiting. So while there's not any, you know, specific lab test or diagnostic test that I can do that says this is a migraine, those are the kinds of things that I'm listening for and specifically asking about to try to figure out if that's the headache type that I'm dealing with.
What's another common cause of headache that, and let's kind of maybe compare that with the symptoms of migraine.
Another really common headache that I would see is a tension-type headache. And while you can get some overlap of the symptoms, complaints of sensitivity to light, nausea, vomiting are quite infrequent with that. And rather than a unilateral throbbing headache, this is oftentimes more located at the base of the neck or all over the head. And it tends to be described as more of a pressure-type sensation. So that's kind of the main differences between those.
I've seen patients with migraine that seem to often have some nausea or vomiting. Is that a common characteristic with migraines, and is it a differential with maybe tension also that's helpful or not?
Yeah, it is a common characteristic of migraines, and when I hear a patient say that they have headaches associated with nausea and vomiting, I do tend to kind of think more towards a migraine. Any kind of severe pain can really bring nausea along with it, so it's not a hard and fast rule, and you can get some nausea, I think, with more severe tension headaches.
Let me remind our listeners, you're listening to Line 1, Your Health Connection. My guest today is Dr. Marcy Troxell, a neurologist here in Anchorage. Our primary topic today is headache, in particular migraine headache. If you've got questions or comments, give us a call. Our local number, 550-8433, toll-free number 1-888-353-5752, and our email address is line1, and you need to spell that out, L-I-N-E-O-N-E, line1@kska.org. We'll be here for the next 50 minutes or so, and then you can also remind your friends or anyone who wants to, with the program repeats tonight from 7 to 8 at 91.1, but we won't be able to take questions or comments at that particular time. What about triggers? You hear so much about people saying that eating cheese or drinking wine or, I don't know, exercise causes my migraine. How reliable are triggers in your experience in true migraine? And I'm choosing my words carefully here.
Well, I actually find that a good proportion of my patients do identify triggers that they associate with their migraines. And one thing that I tell my patients, I think that it can be very, very worthwhile to keep a headache journal. And when you're logging a headache journal, typically you're recording the number of headaches that you have a week or a month, however frequently they are, and how severe the headache is, what you did for it, and also if there was anything associated that brought it on. And the idea behind this is that if you can identify reliably a trigger, then you can make a fairly small lifestyle change that can end up having a big impact on your headaches, and it's less expensive and less hassle than necessarily taking a medication every day. And there are certain triggers that seem to be fairly consistent amongst patients. So many migraineurs tend to be affected by common triggers. And I would say the most common ones amongst those are an increase in stress, a lack of sleep is a very common trigger, changes in hormones. It's very common to have menstrually associated migraines. And also fasting or going without food can cause it. And I'll hear a lot of my patients give those as triggers. And in fact, those are things that I'll ask about to see if we can improve sleep quality in patients. And I'll specifically ask them those questions so that we can try to find some lifestyle modifications to improve their headaches. Then you also have a lot of times people identifying specific triggers. And these can be really specific to one individual. So just because one individual notices that when they eat a certain food, it triggers a migraine, really doesn't mean that all migraineurs should avoid that. And the other pitfall with this that I've seen is sometimes people get very regimented about tracking what they eat and what they do. And again, I'm dealing with a headache population where people could be having headaches on a daily basis by the time they see me. And it can be very difficult, really, to put together a true cause and effect between the triggers. So after a while, you really could start to think that just about anything you ate triggered a migraine because you happened to get a migraine that day. Mm-hmm. So I think it can be worthwhile, but you have to be careful about it. I think the number of times that a very restrictive and stringent diet is worthwhile is probably very, very few. And you have to make sure that when you're journaling your headaches, you're identifying a true cause and effect and not just an association. Yeah.
So if I look at your list of triggers, we often hear about foods, alcohol, cheeses, moles, mm-hmm. and those things. And I've always been a little bit skeptical of that. But your list is more all related to stress, as I see. I mean, you said stress, but also decreased sleep, fasting. These are physiologic stresses, mm-hmm. hormones. We're going to get to, I think we should talk about mm-hmm. menstrual-related migraines as well. Right. But so that's your experience more so for the general migraine sufferer.
Yeah, that's my experience more. So those are the things that if patients don't bring up, I tend to ask them about, because mm-hmm. those are some things that we can talk about that can potentially bring them some improvement.
I'm going to just bring a point up that I don't think we've ever mentioned on the program. I mean, when you're looking at cause and effect, you're looking at two things in general, I would think, is that when you eat or do something, it inevitably or very commonly causes it. When you don't do it, then it doesn't happen. I think sometimes we have patients thinking, like you said, if you're having headaches every day, then why do you pick on apples when you ate them?
It could
be all these other things that happen every day. So, okay. Steve, you're on line one. What can we do for you?
Yeah, I don't have migraines. I had another funny little problem happen that I wondered if I could ask you about, if you don't mind.
Lay it on us.
About 4 or 5 years ago, I was sitting there, and I saw this backwards C on the wall in white light, about 18 inches tall, but I knew it wasn't there, so I covered one eye, and it was still there, and I covered the other eye, and it was still there. And I've never had any other problems besides that. Was that like a stroke or something like that? What do you suppose that was? I mean, it wasn't there. It was a kind of a funny illusion.
Mm-hmm. Right. Do you happen to remember how long that lasted for you?
A couple minutes, maybe a minute or two.
Mm-hmm. So, you know, with eye findings, I'd always probably start with the caveat that there are perhaps some visual-related things that aren't always on my differential, not being an eye specialist. But one thing that can happen actually kind of is related to migraines, and what we're talking about here today is something called ocular migraine. And I don't know if you were listening a few minutes ago where we were talking about auras, but patients with migraines can get what we refer to as an aura. And these are neurologic symptoms such as vision changes or sensory changes or vertigo or a spinning sensation that happen before a headache.
And yeah, I caught that. That's what kind of keyed me in on it.
Right. Yeah, and the thing about auras that is kind of interesting is that sometimes they can happen without the accompanying headache. So a lot of times I will see patients in my office that have been sent over after having seen an eye doctor or an ophthalmologist, and they're sent over because they experience these transient visual changes, usually seeing spots or seeing, you know, a shimmering arc is actually not uncommon, kind of a C-shaped thing like you discussed.
Yeah.
And
I thought it was in my brain because it was with either eye, you know, I covered mm-hmm. one, then I covered the other.
Yeah, and it's very commonly in both eyes when you're dealing with an ocular migraine. And it will be transient and go away and can happen without a headache. If I hear people tell me that they have a history of headaches also, even if they didn't have a headache with the attack, that kind of also leads me towards that pathway. But yeah, that's a possibility.
It's been 4 or 5 years, and I'm not dead, so I guess I don't have much to worry about.
That's good news.
Yeah. All right, thanks a lot.
Keep exercising. All right, Justice, you're on line one.
Oh, greetings. I've been doing research for a long time on the harm that fluorescent lights do to people, mm-hmm. And latterly the compact fluorescents do. And of course, I run into migraine people who most of the time know exactly what I'm talking about right away. Mm-hmm. Could you talk a little bit about, fluorescent light, the flicker? Maybe it's the electromagnetic that's just in our electromagnetic smog.
Yeah.
The effect that fluorescents have on people is related to the brain.
Sure. Well, you know, I can speak definitely to fluorescent lights and the fact that they can have an impact on migraines and worsen migraines. Now, as far as any permanent damage or insult occurring to the brain from the fluorescent lights, I'm not really aware of an association there. But
I'm talking more like an allergy. You know, if you remove mm-hmm. the source of the what's giving you the reaction, it goes away. And most people seem to have what would be defined as an allergy to fluorescent lights on some scale or another, and usually they don't recognize it's the lights. You know, they hate to go into Walmart, but they don't know why. Or their office makes their eyes burn, but they don't really associate it with the lighting, rather than migraine. I mean, the migraine people get it right away.
Right. Yeah. I mean, I would agree with that a lot of times when people are experiencing a photosensitivity or a sensitivity to light, they may not really recognize, again, like you said, why they don't want to go into a certain place. It's very common with migraines to be sensitive to light.
Right.
And so the flickering, the fluorescent lights can set off a migraine and cause a worsening there.
Photophobia or migraines or sensitivity to brightness spectrum or glare. It's more like the flicker affecting your brain, and you don't know, you don't realize unless you've looked into it, maybe it's these kind of lights that make me have these headaches, you know, that kind of thing.
I'm not sure I understand what you're saying, but I do think that the flickering of the lights can set off a headache. Yes, I think that's and can set off other types of stimulation in your brain. It's also well known that flickering lights can cause a seizure or epileptiform activity. So, yeah, it can have an effect there with, I suppose, some type of neuronal firing or nerve cell firing in your brain. I wouldn't necessarily term that an allergy, but it can have an effect with headaches, particularly migraines, and seizures as well.
All right. Okay. I was heading more towards just subtle. It seems to set off symptoms in people, and they don't go off in any particular order. You know, either their eyes are burning or, oh, I lose focus, I can't concentrate, or jumps right to headache, or headache develops after hours, all having to do with, because it's so subtle and the onsets are different in different spaces, and yet when they leave those spaces, that's when it's like an allergy. You know, if you stop eating corn and you're allergic to corn, you don't have those symptoms anymore, whatever those symptoms were.
Medical
brain firing and headaches, that's what I'm talking about.
Definitions are important, and from a medical standpoint, allergy by definition is something that you can measure the body's reaction to with an antibody and or a lymphocyte response. And so you're talking about lights as triggers to various symptoms.
Right. And if you go out of the light,
right,
the symptoms go away.
Just, right.
Right. Sort of the very definition of allergy.
Well, it's the definition of a lot of things. If you avoid them, you get better. I don't think it's specific to allergy, per se. I think the use of the term allergy here is not correct from a purely medical standpoint. You're looking at a cause and effect. I think when you start saying that there's multiple different kinds of symptoms, then the other thing that's important is what is there a defined, well-understood mechanism for these things to be occurring? And what I hear Dr. Troxell saying is it's clearly it can be associated with triggering migraines in certain individuals.
Well, sure, migraines. That one's well known. Okay. Thank you very much.
Yeah, thanks for your call, Justice. An email says, is there a relationship between ocular migraines, and perhaps you might want to define that a little bit more, you've already talked about it a little bit, and cardiovascular disease or the potential for aneurysms?
Any association between ocular migraines and aneurysms. And I will go into the definition a little bit more because I think by definition, ocular migraine, again, is more of a primary syndrome. And when we say primary syndrome, it means that there's not an underlying cause, such as an aneurysm or a tumor or things like that. So while visual changes could certainly be associated with other things, an ocular migraine in and of itself would not be. So again, an ocular migraine is when you get visual changes, can be Loss of vision can be dark spots in your vision, can be zigzags or geometric shapes. Most of the time, this will kind of start in the center of the vision and move outwards towards the periphery. Sometimes as the abnormal shapes or zigzags move out towards the periphery, that will be followed by more of a dark spot in the vision. And then the center vision is the first to recover. So these don't tend to be associated with aneurysms, and I'm not aware of an increased incidence of vascular disease or heart disease with that.
Yeah, we went through a period where a patent foramen ovale was associated with strokes, and I'm just trying to understand perhaps where this may be coming from. Is that worth bringing up? Is there any relationship to migraine?
No, yeah, I think that it is because the studies have been somewhat conflicting and studies are ongoing. So in essence, there have been some trials that did show that there was a higher incident of PFO in patients that had migraines. And there were some studies that didn't really show a higher incidence. To date, there's no strong data showing that surgical repair of a PFO offers you any benefit in migraine therapy. But there are studies that are continuing and ongoing in that. But to date, right now, there's no compelling evidence that a surgical correction of that is going to improve your migraines.
Yeah, PFO is a patent foramen ovale. It's a mixing of blood in the atrium of the heart between the venous and the arterial side, where the thought was that opening could increase risks of strokes and migraines, is my recollection. Is that, that right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Okie doke. Let's take one more caller before we go on to a break. Bob, you're on line one.
Hi, doctors. How you doing?
Good.
Good.
My name is Bob, and I'm an Imitrex addict.
Okay.
Not really, but that's my regular treatment of choice.
Mm-hmm.
I'm just wondering about, I recall a column a couple years ago by a New York Times columnist, Judith Warner, who apparently experienced pretty regular migraines and tried all the dietary stuff and finally tried a number of different meds and found each of them wanting in its own way because of affecting her mental acuity. And I just wonder, a couple questions really. One is, how does Imitrex stack up these days? Is there anything better for a regular pattern of non-specific migraines, but clearly migraine in nature? And second, if somebody is going to end up needing so-called preventive meds, is there stuff that is more benign with respect to mental function than other types of meds?
Well, I think those are all really good questions, and it might be worthwhile, if we have the time right now, to kind of go a little bit into how we treat migraines. So, you know, we already talked about triggers and trying to avoid triggers. And then there are non-pharmacologic treatments that can be employed, such as managements to reduce stress and biofeedback. And then when you start talking about medications, there's kind of two different things that you need to look at. One is how to abort a headache or stop an acute headache. And that, of course, is the intent of Imitrex. And what you have to be careful of with abortive therapies or medications that are used to abort headache is that if you use them too frequently, you can actually get into a rebound headache or a withdrawal headache, whereby that headache can develop into a chronic daily headache that you're having every day based on withdrawing from that acute abortive therapy. And so when you're having to use your abortive therapy more than a couple of times per week, that's usually when it's a good idea to start a preventative medication. So I think one of your questions, and let me know if I miss any, one of them was, is Imitrex still a good drug? Are there better medications out there? Is that right?
Correct.
So typically, if you're experiencing kind of mild headaches, the first thing we try will be actually over-the-counter medications like Tylenol, or anti-inflammatories, ibuprofen, medications like that. And if they work to abort a headache, then that's really all you need, and you don't need to necessarily use a prescription medication. Of course, in my clinic, I'm usually dealing with people that that did not work well for, and that's usually why they end up in my clinic. And so Imitrex is from a group of medications called triptans. And they are very effective for aborting a migraine. And as a group, I think there's about 8 of them total. And they all work pretty similarly in effectiveness. Now, if somebody doesn't respond to one triptan medication, I will try other triptan medications because for some reason or another, an individual person might respond to one and not respond to the other. But in patient populations, there's not one triptan medication that I would consider head and shoulders above the others.
So to speak.
Right, exactly. So essentially, if it's working for you, if Imitrex works for you, then it's a good medication, and I would keep using that for abortive therapy. But it sounds like you're using it too much, or maybe you were just joking.
I'm kind of joking because it's been irregular, and I think it's going to go generic now, so that would address one of the operations
Bob,
the hassle of it, if you use it to be able to sort of play through a headache, for example, to play through an aura and racquetball, is that a bad thing, or is the rebound any more likely, or is there any research on that kind of specific question?
Sure. Well, again, I think it's a lot what your personal experience is. Exercise and physical activity does tend to exacerbate migraines. When people get a migraine, they kind of want to hole up in a dark room with the lights off, no sound, and no movement. So, you know, if you ask me the question, if I go and play racquetball when I have a migraine, is that going to make it worse? I'd say there's a good chance that it would. But if you tell me, when I notice a migraine coming on and I want to go and play racquetball, I take an Imitrex and then I can go and play, is there any harm in doing that? I would say no.
Great.
How successful?
No answer. I appreciate it.
How successful is Imitrex for you when used early?
Comparing the other sort of over-the-counter meds to Imitrex, the beauty of it for me, just one anecdotal case, is that I'm able to be somewhat, I can start later with the med and still have it be effective.
Right.
None of that other stuff works at all once I delay past the aura. But with Imitrex, you can go in and intervene late in the process and still have good results.
You're using it as a nasal spray?
No, actually the one I use is just the pills because when I get it before the nausea kicks in, it works.
Well.
I've tried nasal. I've actually tried the shots too. The shots are very effective, but not that much fun to do in your leg.
I've heard it said that, and I'm asking Dr. Troxell to comment on this, that, you know, so often nausea, vomiting is associated with migraine, and so there's a sense that oral medications may not be useful because of vomiting, because the medications are not absorbed, there's a delay of emptying of the stomach, a lot of reasons, so that the nasal sprays are often have that distinct advantage. Dr. Troxell, your comments on that?
Yeah, that is true. There can be a lot of problem associated with taking an oral medication from vomiting and slow gastric emptyings, making it slow to absorb the medication. I find, however, that most of my patients can take an oral triptan medication and that it works very well in them. Okay. And when I turn to nasal sprays or injections is typically if someone has profound vomiting and I know they're not going to keep it down and they know they're not going to keep it down, or if they tell me that an oral medication isn't working for them. One thing that you brought up, actually, with abortive therapy is that you want to take it just as soon as possible. It tends to be more effective the sooner that you take it. And so when you use some of these routes of delivery that allow it to get into your system faster, then it can make it so it's that route is more effective in treating a migraine, even in the absence of vomiting.
Okay. Bob, thanks for your call.
Again, very thorough treatment.
Yep. Thank you. We're going to have to take a short break. I know there's a couple of people hanging on the telephone, several of emails. We'll do our best to get to all of those, but I want to remind everyone you're listening to Line 1, Your Health Connection. Our local number, 550-8433. Our email address is line1@kska.org. We're going to take one short break, and then we'll be back taking emails and calls with Dr. Marcy Troxell. I'm Dr. Thad Woodard.
Part of today's program, or if you'd like to listen again to Line 1, Your Health Connection, the program repeats tonight at 7 on FM 91.1. Remember, tonight's rebroadcast is recorded and will not be taking telephone calls. A copy of today's program will be available on our website at kska.org. This is KSKA Anchorage.
Welcome back. You're listening to Line 1, Your Health Connection, and I'm your host, Dr. Thad Woodard. My guest today is Anchorage neurologist, Dr. Marcy Troxell. We're talking about migraine. We talked a little bit about other headaches. It looks like we're going to stick with migraine unless you all have some other questions. Email questions to us at line1@kska.org. Our phone number locally, 550-8433, and our toll-free number, 1-888-353-5752. And remember, if you're listening between 7 and 8, you're listening to a recorded rebroadcast. Dan, you're on line one. What can we do for you?
I had a question. Actually, it was a little not on the lines of migraines, but about a year ago, I started having painful, acute pain on the right side of my head, right in my temple area. And it lasted long enough that I went to see a specialist, and he wasn't a neurologist, but he basically went through all the tests for migraines, and I went through and had the CAT scan and everything, and was able to rule everything out, and he ended up diagnosing me with cluster headaches, and I didn't know if maybe there was something you could speak on about cluster headaches and how that is different than a migraine, and what other than he put me on a drug called Inderal, a beta blocker, and basically said that's kind of the indefinite that's going to be kind of the indefinite prescription until, you know, I guess things change or the headache goes away. For the last year or so, it's been fairly constant, and I can't, very unpredictable. It just comes and goes.
How many times a day?
That's the thing. It's not necessarily every day. Sometimes it can be once a week, but when it does roll around, it can be very painful to the point where it distracts me for the entire day, or, barely noticeable. I can't tell that the drug necessarily has any relative effect, mm-hmm. but as I sit right now, that has been the prescribed method of dealing with it.
Ever mm-hmm. ever wake you at night?
Not necessarily, no.
And do you have more than one of those in a day?
When it does happen, it kind of lasts for a length of time, say 4 to 8 hours. And I've been, over the course of the last year, I've been really trying to determine what is the cause and effect of whether I have it or don't have it. And I haven't really been able to put my finger on anything in particular. I definitely have had stress headaches in the past, and it's different than that. But I can't say that stress doesn't, bring this on in particular. But it's always in the exact same spot and almost the exact same intensity when it does occur.
I'm just trying to play doctor. I'm gonna say this is doesn't
my
sound.
Doctor, I've seen my doctor several times about it, and he does not seem concerned at all. And he said it's a cluster headache, and it's very common. But I haven't really been able to find a lot of information on cluster headaches, and what I have found doesn't seem to really
relate to what I have specifically. So I'm kind of a little bit lost. You know,
well, that's my guess, too, is this doesn't sound much like a cluster headache, but let's ask Dr. Troxell. She's the one that'll help us.
Yeah. So cluster headaches actually they're pretty uncommon headache type, and they do tend to happen in men, particularly young men. And the typical characteristic of a cluster headache is that you can get a pretty acute onset of very severe lancinating type pain. And it does tend to be in the temple area and around the eye. But features that accompany a cluster headache that really are the hallmark of that headache are the fact that the headaches tend to be fairly short-lasting. There's an exception to that where you can develop a chronic cluster headache that doesn't go away. But, you know, they tend to last anywhere from 5 minutes to a little over an hour, tend to be quite severe incapacitating pain, and they can be associated on the side of the headache. They're usually associated with tearing at the eye, a droopy eyelid, a constricted pupil, sometimes sweating on that side of the face, a runny nose, or what we refer to as some of these autonomic symptoms that accompany a cluster. And that's the typical characteristic that I look for when I'm diagnosing with a cluster headache. I don't really hear you describing that.
No, none of that. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, it doesn't seem like I have any of the other symptoms of a migraine. Mm-hmm. And I tried to play it off for a while as just being, you know, just an inconvenience and something. But it's lasted so long and so consistently that it's not excruciating pain where I can't concentrate on anything, but it's enough to really distract me throughout the entire day.
And what is the characteristic of the pain that you're experiencing there in your temple?
Well, it's a sharp, acute pain, mm-hmm. almost in exactly the same spot, right mm-hmm. on my temple. And mm-hmm. What brings it on? I can't tell. I mean, I sometimes will wake up with it, and sometimes it'll just start happening. You know, sometime mm-hmm. towards the middle of the day.
Does it shoot down into your face, or just stay pretty much localized right there at the temple?
It's real localized. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I did have a lot of testing done initially to kind of rule out mm-hmm. anything major, and they weren't able to find anything that they were very concerned with. So mm-hmm. my doctor kind of ruled it off as a cluster headache and has been prescribing me Inderol and said, mm-hmm. you know, that has something to do with, you know, definitely my heart rate has slowed. but I don't notice that it's necessarily had a direct effect mm-hmm. on the headaches. So
you know,
I don't know really whether I need to take a different course or what I do there, you know?
Right, right. Well, you know, again, I would agree that it doesn't sound very much like a cluster headache to me. And sometimes what you can run into with headache syndromes are that you might not get a definite syndrome when all is said and done. And the important thing there is that you've worked it up for underlying causes. You know, had your imaging studies done and your doctor has said that he doesn't find anything else. So then the main reason that we really try to categorize these into symptoms is, again, to pick an appropriate preventative therapy for someone like yourself that is, you know, having these ongoing headaches. And there's all different kinds of headache syndromes. You know, one type of headache called jabs and jolts, which kind of gives you little jabs of sharp pain, tends to go in different areas on your head. There can be headache syndromes where you get sharp stabbing pain just down one side of your face. And those types of headaches, the jabs and jolts headaches, the paroxysmal hemicrania is the other one that I was talking about, cluster headaches, they all tend to kind of be grouped together because similar medications can be used to treat them. We use a lot of times in treating headaches, seizure medicines, blood pressure medicines, which is what you're on, and antidepressants. And a lot of times what I'll do, if I'm not pinning anything down into a specific headache syndrome, then I'll kind of look at the characteristic or quality of the pain, and sharp stabbing pain or jabs and jolts will lead me towards one medication choice that I think, well, try this one because this one might work the best in you. And with headaches, a lot of times it can be a bit of a trial and error to find an appropriate preventative medication. But it sounds like, you know, if the propranolol hasn't made much of a change in your headaches, that that's probably not the right medicine for you, and you can, you know, then consider a change of therapy and trials of different medications to get some improvement in your pain. Sometimes I have to go through a lot of different medication types.
What would you recommend that I do at this point to kind of try Plan B? I mean, where would I go from here?
Well, you could take a visit to a neurologist that could make further recommendations. For sharp stabbing type pain, a lot of times I use a seizure medicine that's called Tegretol, and I find good response there. And also there's an anti-inflammatory medication that I use a lot for sharp stabbing type pain.
Yeah, I would get your primary physician and say, look, I've been on Inderol, it's not getting better. You listen to this the neurologist on the radio, and it didn't sound like, you know, cluster headaches to her. What do you think? We get another opinion. And I mean, I think if it's bothering you significantly, it seems pretty clear that the Inderol is not helping you, and that perhaps we need to be doing something different.
And by now, you know, it's been a year, so yep. it's kind of yep. at the point where it hasn't gotten worse and it hasn't gotten better, and I'm trying to figure out what to do next. So
I don't blame you.
Thank you very much for your help. I really appreciate it.
No problem.
Good luck. Here's an email. Is there a particular part of the brain that ocular migraines usually start in? I chose this one because I really would like you to discuss what in the world is going on in the brain and migraine anyway. She's implying that it starts somewhere. So is this a brain problem, and what's going on?
Yeah, it is a brain problem. And I think, you know, about 20 years ago, we had a bit more of a simplistic view on what was causing migraine headaches. And it really was believed to be due to constriction and dilation of the blood vessels that are in and around the brain. And so primarily a vascular problem or a problem with the blood vessels. And the newer theories that are emerging, you know, the exact and specific mechanisms aren't always known, but it's believed more now to be a primary problem with the nerve cells inside your brain or the neurons firing. And they can fire spontaneously, and this firing then spreads along the outer portion of your brain. And that can be associated then with constriction of the blood vessels or dilation and decreased blood flow to different areas. But it's really believed to start with this spontaneous firing of nerve cells that leads to various substances that perpetuate pain being released, and inflammation, and all of this acts together to bring on the headache.
And so does ocular migraine versus menstrual migraine versus posterior migraine, other kinds of migraine, do they start in different parts of the brain?
No, I wouldn't say that we've come to the point where we can really pin down different areas. We do know various parts of the brain where pain is sensed, and things that are involved in the pain pathways. And in particular, there is one nerve in the brain, the trigeminal nerve, that is a sensory nerve to your face and a lot of the blood vessels and some of the meninges, or that's a covering around the brain. And so that nerve is involved, and the bodies of the nerve cells are kind of housed in the brainstem there. So there are various structures in the brainstem and throughout the brain that are involved in pain cycles. But as far as different types of migraines starting in a specific area, I don't think we've pinned down yet to exactly where an ocular migraine starts.
Kiddo. Jessica, what can we do for you? Hello, Jessica, you're on line one. Are you there? Right, let's go to Denise. Are you on line one?
I am. Hello.
Yeah, what can we do for you?
Well, I was diagnosed with classic migraine, which I'm assuming is ocular migraine. When I was about 13, I thought I was dying. We thought I had a brain tumor. I was missing school once a month. It was horrible. and the pain would last for 10, 12 hours. I would just lay there and cry. It was awful. Mm-hmm. And even in my adult life, I suffered horribly. I had to pack up and leave the second I got one. I couldn't continue working or anything. I couldn't drive. And then I discovered Imitrex, and the pills didn't work, but the nasal spray has changed my life. It's just, it made me be able to live a normal life.
Oh, good. I'm so happy to hear that.
And I asked my doctor, should I try something else? Because I've been taking Imitrex now for, you know, 15, 20 years or so. And he said the same thing. He said, if it ain't broke, don't fix it.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. If it's working well for you, great. And I think...
Oh, it's amazing. It's amazing. But I did want to ask you, so is it still... I always understood that it was... The blood vessel would collapse, and that's what caused the vision problems, and then the blood vessel, the backup would come in, and that's what would cause the pain. Is that basically what happened?
Well, I think, you know, the visual problems, I think, are more associated with the abnormal nerve firing in the brain. Although, again, vascular constriction and dilation does accompany that, but the primary pathology that's going on really is that abnormal nerve firing in the brain.
I heard you say that. That is something new that I did not know.
Yeah. And the other thing I was just going to mention, although terminology, I think, isn't always the most important thing. So a classical migraine is what they used to refer to a migraine with aura.
Right.
So not all migraine sufferers have an aura, and it's actually more common, believe it or not, to not experience an aura than to experience an aura. But nevertheless, the classical migraine, that was the term for migraine with aura, and common migraine was the term for migraine without aura.
Yeah, mm-hmm. The couple of people that I know that get migraine identical to mine but without the aura, the mm-hmm. Imitrex does not work for them.
That's interesting. That's interesting. Usually, I've found triptans to be pretty equally effective for migraine with aura or without aura. That's, of course, when it's a true migraine, and it may be sometimes that those other headache syndromes might not be a true migraine. That might not
right.
be why they're.
Well, I appreciate the program. That's an important topic. Thank you.
All right.
No problem.
We have a couple of emails that are beating around the menstrual or hormonal factors. I think it is worth for sure mentioning menstrual migraine, the theories about menstrual migraine, and how treatment might differ for those.
Okay. So, you know, you can have two different things occurring with menstrual migraines. You can have a primary menstrual migraine, which is actually less common. And in those cases, that would be women that only experience migraines around the time of their menstrual cycle. And then you can also have patients that have migraines but will report that they worsen around the time of their period. And that's very, very common, which is one of the reasons when you were asking me about triggers, I say, yes, this is a common trigger, because women that tend to have migraines, it's very, very common that if you ask if they worsen around the time of their period, they will say yes. And they can become more severe and more refractory to treatment around the time of their period as well, so that perhaps an abortive therapy like Imitrex might work most of the time, but they're more refractory to it around the time of their period. So the trigger for what is believed to be happening in menstrual migraines is a drop in estrogen levels. And that's typically occurring just immediately before your menstrual cycle. And so there are a lot of different things that you can do for this. And much of it depends on the particular patient that you're treating. In general, the abortive medications that you're going to use are going to be the same. So when you develop a migraine and it's your period, you're going to take Imitrex or another triptan medication to abort the headache. You also can, as we talked about before, use anti-inflammatories like ibuprofen or Tylenol if those are effective for you. So the acute treatment of the headache is essentially the same. But for people that tend to experience more refractory headaches, and they're happening mainly around their period, a lot of times you can use a short course of preventative therapy with either scheduled daily dosing of anti-inflammatories or scheduled dosing of triptan medications. And of course, you do have to be cautious with that, because if you let that go on too long, then you're back to worrying about a rebound headache. But that's something that you can do in the days starting just before your period, up to a couple of days after your period has started. Other therapies would include giving a little bit of extra estrogen around that time, or you can use birth control pills or hormonal replacement that gives a consistent supply of estrogen. So in other words, rather than having a week of sugar pills or placebo pills when you're taking birth control pills, you have a week where you're getting pills that have less estrogen but are still supplying you with some estrogen. And really, I think one of the things that has to be taken account there is the goals of therapy. If it's someone that's looking for contraceptive therapy anyways, then giving them a birth control pill and maybe either continuously cycling through or adding additional estrogen would be a good treatment plan for that person. Whereas people that aren't good candidates for hormonal therapy would be less likely to pursue that route in those patients. And that would include women over the age of 35 that are also smokers, because then you get into increased cardiovascular risk and stroke risk, and you don't want to add hormonal therapies on top of that.
All right. We have about 2 minutes left. Scott, you're on line one. Let me first apologize to everybody that we didn't get to and remind you that if you go to our website, ksk.org/line1, there are 4 web links, 2 specifically to information about migraines in general that you may want to go to. Scott, what can we do for you? We have to do it real quick. Scott's not with us anymore. How about, are you there?
Yeah, I'm here. I can hear you.
Yep. Well, good. Then I can hear you, but we got less than a minute or so. What can we do for you?
Well, I used to get multiple migraines a week, and I would take Maxalt and Imitrex, and they work great. But I found a supplement that got rid of my migraines almost completely. It's called tryptophan. In particular, it's called 8-5-HTP, which is hydrotryptophan. And I take 4 times the recommended amount. And my migraines have disappeared, as well as my chronic low-level depression and memory problems. And, yeah, that's it.
Okay. All right. Well, thanks for your call, Scott.
Okay.
What are your thoughts about tryptophan?
Well, you know, there's not a lot of randomized data out there with tryptophan. In the pain cycle, there are various hormones that come into play, and serotonin is really believed to be a big player there, and so that may be why the tryptophan is somewhat effective. I don't know about the higher than recommended dosage, and again, I don't know of a lot of randomized controlled trials showing particular effectiveness of that particular medication. Yeah.
So a common issue is people who seem to get better. The natural history of migraines is that they may suddenly just disappear and go away, so that it doesn't mean cause and effect. And and really good studies are what Dr. Troxell's talking about, so that we can see when there's really clear cause and effect, which requires, unfortunately, multiple patients being tested in the same way. Thanks very much for your time, Dr. Troxell. We appreciate it.
No problem. Thank you for having me.
Let me remind everybody we're going to return next week, and my guest will be interventional radiologist Dr. Eric Maurer, and we're going to be talking about how new technologies in radiology are allowing less invasive procedures for diagnosis and treatment of vascular diseases. Pat Yak is vice president of APTI News and Public Media. Kristen Spack engineered today's program. I want to say thanks again for listening, especially those who called and emails, and our apologies for not being able to reach and answer all of those questions. I'm Dr. Thad Woodard. Have a great day.
Line 1, Your Health Connection is a production of Alaska Public Telecommunications Incorporated, which is solely responsible for its content. Views expressed are those of the participants and do not reflect KSKA or its underwriters. Today's program is available on our website at kska.org. CD copies can be purchased by calling 550-8400. This is KSKA Anchorage.